on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Netflix tries shuffering Verizon. China refuses to pirate Windows 8. And VDI. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 94, recorded June 6, 2014, for Monday, June 9, 2014. VDI versus server huggers and EMP. Fight. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code ENTERPRISE to receive $10 off at checkout. And by RingCentral. The cloud-based phone system we use just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs at RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to TWIT. Wait, where did that go? That did not fade.
Sorry, I didn't know if that I had to fade it myself.
Yeah, it takes otherwise it just sits there.
All right.
Let's do it again.
Okay, we'll
that's cool.
We'll do that again. All right, that's the next one.
That's Doji.
Okay. All right. Take two.
Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballas here, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I'm joined by my good friend and fellow geek, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how hot is it there right now?
It's not bad, but my wife and I will be going to the American Library Association conference in Las Vegas in a couple weeks, and it is triple-digit scorching.
Yes, but it's a dry heat. It's a dry heat, so it should be okay. Fantastic.
Baked Chibert.
It's always good to see you, Chibert. So what do you say? We don't have Curtis Franklin this week. He's off in Disneyland somewhere. Actually, he's at a conference in Florida, and he's gathering us all the intelligence we need to make the decisions that well-informed IT people need to make. But without him, what do you say? We get into the blips. First one comes to us from Network World. It's all about Microsoft needing some love. That's right. Nobody likes Microsoft anymore, not even the hackers. Seriously, though, this is good news for users of Microsoft's suite of products. Year over year, there has been a 30% drop in the number of security bulletins that have had to be issued for Microsoft's Internet Explorer, Windows, and Office. At the half-year mark of 2013, Microsoft had issued 50 bulletins, with 16 of them being critical. At the same point this year, they've issued 35, with only 12 of them rated as critical.
Well, the Washington Post brings us the announcement of the first White House Maker Faire. Now, you might remember a couple years back, 16-year-old Joey Huddy, fired a marshmallow cannon across the White House state dining room and then handed President Obama a business card that said, "Don't be bored, make something." And that became the rallying cry that helped kick off the very first White House Maker Faire coming up this June 18th. Add your maker voice by tweeting #, I made this, and posting what you've made. There's a chance your image will become part of President Obama's call to arms for Americans to make stuff, keeping in mind just how active Michelle Obama has been in encouraging STEM education.
Speaking of making stuff, Sprint and T-Mobile sitting in a tree, making Monopoly. According to people with knowledge of the matter, Sprint has reached a deal to buy T-Mobile for about $32 billion. The deal would combine the number 3 and 4 carrier in the United States into an entity that would rival number 1 and 2, AT&T and Verizon. Like the AT&T T-Mobile deal that fell apart, there is purportedly a clause that would have Sprint leaving a large chunk of change on the table should regulatory approval not come about.
we can only hope that the deal goes through, because if there's one thing we've learned from the ISP battle over net neutrality, fewer players is always a good thing for the consumer.
Well, I've got a shocking story about ceramic fuel cells could be the future of green at-home power and heat generation. We've all drooled over Bloom Energy's Bloombox fuel cells being used by folks like Google, Yahoo, eBay, and others. But the materials and complexity of manufacturing put these magic boxes out of the reach of the residential user. The key here is that once electricity is made by your local power plant, it's a perishable commodity. With natural gas-fueled powered fuel cells, you get higher efficiencies than traditional power generation, and you only make as much power as you need right now. Fraunhofer Institute researchers are using a ceramic anode in a solid oxide fuel cell that produces both electricity and a lot of heat. So perhaps we'll have a ceramic fuel cell both heating and powering our homes in the future.
Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about a new way to achieve net neutrality through shame. But before we do that, I thought we should take a moment to thank the first sponsor of the Twiat Riot, and that's LegalZoom. Now, when we start thinking about the great minds of the generation, we know that America was built by those innovators and dreamers who dared think outside of the box. People like Nikola Tesla, Thomas Edison, and Henry Ford, they laid the foundation not just for our industry, but really for the world. These days, it's the inventors and the entrepreneurs all around us that keep our country running by fueling the job market and economy. It's the geek like you who will dream up something undreamable, tinker something into existence, and disrupt what we think is possible. Well, this month, LegalZoom celebrates innovation by helping you to launch your dream. Apply for a patent to secure your invention. Register your trademark to protect your products and services. Incorporate or form an LLC and launch your business. They've helped over a million businesses get started right, and they received an A+ from the Better Business Bureau. Celebrate innovation with LegalZoom today and get a special price on trademark, copyright, or provisional patent applications by using the offer code ENTERPRISE at checkout. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help services, but they're not a law firm. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to take your next great idea and protect it. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code ENTERPRISE to save on your legal needs and get access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. Don't put off the things you need to do. Go to LegalZoom.com right now and use the offer code ENTERPRISE. That's LegalZoom.com, offer code ENTERPRISE, to receive $10 off at checkout. We thank LegalZoom for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Cheever, let's get right to it. We've got a story here that I actually really kind of like. It's kind of, I don't know, what would happen when someone's getting bullied around the schoolyard and they figure a really brilliant way to get back at their bully. Netflix probably feeling a little down in the dumps by getting, let's just say, shanghaied by Verizon and Comcast bandwidth extortion, has resorted to a time-tested method of fighting against the bigger guy. Shame. That's right. Netflix has been adding a piece of text to their buffering screen that lays the blame for congested networks at the feet of those networks by name. As you can see in this graphic, it says the Verizon network is crowded right now, adjusting video for smoother playback. Now, this has rankled Verizon, who seems to be named in a high percentage of those screens, those shame buffering, or what I call shuffering screens. In fact, it's bothering them so much that they sent a cease and desist letter to Netflix saying, indeed, in the first instance, responsibility for its customers' experience falls squarely on Netflix itself. Netflix has the ability to directly connect to every broadband network in America should it choose to do so. Instead, Netflix relies on a panoply of content distribution and other middleman networks to reach its customers, trying to lower its cost as much as possible. The cost-quality trade-off is one Netflix has chosen. Now, Cheebert, I want to throw this over to you first, because the code in the open letter that Verizon wrote to Netflix is, well, Netflix chose to use the internet because the internet is about interconnected networks. But if they would just pay us to use our network exclusively for our customers, everything would be okay. So therefore, they're at fault. Makes sense, right? But I mean, this is actually true. I mean, Netflix does have a point in that Verizon has a point if Netflix truly wanted to provide uninterrupted service to to Verizon customers, they could contact directly with Verizon to put data centers directly into Verizon's network and therefore provide much smoother, much better service. But then the problem is that's no longer the internet, right? I mean, that's just building a lot of walled gardens, a lot of AOLs, yeah. And you have to buy your way into each and every single one of them.
Yeah, and I should also point out that Netflix is actually in some really, really cool facilities that have an insane amount of bandwidth and an insane number of cross connects. So I'm not feeling any love for Verizon complaining.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another interesting point in their letter is that they never claimed that they weren't throttling Netflix or the interconnects, but rather, again, it's Netflix's fault for not paying Verizon what they say is a connection fee, what everyone else is calling extortion, for the ability to connect to Verizon's customers. Now, Netflix did respond, and they wrote in their open letter, and I quote, "We are testing ways to let consumers know how their Netflix experience is being affected by congestion on their broadband provider's network. At present, we are testing in the United States in areas serviced by many broadband providers. This test started in early May, and it is ongoing. Our test continues." The interesting thing is that Netflix is drawing on some reports that they did and some information that came out of Level 3 that is showing that it's not just a matter of companies paying their due, but rather that there are some ISPs who mostly go unnamed, but we're going to name them here, Verizon, Comcast, Time Warner, who seem to be have the vast majority of oversubscribed links. Now, let me bring up some information. We covered this in a previous episode of Twiet, but I think it's worth repeating. Now, Level 3, which is one of the largest broadband backbone providers in the world, they connect pretty much everything. They may connect to thousands, tens of thousands of customers, but they really only have 51 peers. Now, those peers are located in 45 cities. Those peers are the way that information travels back and forth through different networks on the internet. Now, each peer is connected, or those peers are connected to 1,360 10 gigabit per second Ethernet ports. Each peer has 1 to 20 interconnection points, which means that's a point which traffic can travel from one network to another. The average interconnection link is about 36% utilization, but 12 of 51 of their peers are congested at or above 90%. At that utilization, you see a lot of drop packets for several hours each day. Six of those 12 are currently in the process of making upgrades, but the remaining six, and again, you could probably guess which six those are chronically congested. Those peers are making no effort to upgrade their system to decrease that congestion. The scuttlebutt is that Verizon is one of the chronically congested peers that is not making any move to correct the congestion, at least not without being paid. Cheever, let me ask you, because this again goes back to the fundamental nature of the internet, of the peering agreements, the peering arrangements in which networks agree to connect to one another to let the traffic flow freely. Otherwise, we don't have an internet, right? I mean, that's why a lot of us are so upset, because that's what's at stake. If we start putting toll booths up, it breaks peering, which breaks the internet.
Well, this is even worse. I don't know of any internet engineer that could keep their job if they let a link get all the way up to 90% congestion. Most people start looking at upgrading it right when it even hits into the 40-45% range. Once you get to 90, you can absolutely guarantee that things are going to break, and break dramatically.
Right. Yeah, I remember we saw a graphic not too long ago that showed you what traffic looks like. I mean, it spikes during the day. If you've got a 10 gigabit per second line and it's 30% utilized, it doesn't mean that it's always running at 30%. It'll go from 30% up to 100, back down, back up, back down. If you're at 90%, you hit those peaks. And when you hit the top, it means you're now dropping traffic. It means there's now traffic that's just falling on the floor and has to be retransmitted. And any IT administrator, anyone who has worked with networks, knows that that actually has a cumulative effect. If you have a lot of networks retransmitting their data, it actually increases the amount of bandwidth that has to flow through the network. So, Cheever, let me ask you this. We've got Netflix doing this shaming thing. Do you think it will be useful in maybe educating the public as to the things they should be aware of?
You bet. You know, there is no one answer. There is no one person at fault. It is a shade of gray. And when you have a network as complicated as what's in currently in the United States, there's a lot of cross connects. There's a lot of peering. There's a lot of this and that. But Verizon is starting to play a political game. It's not a technology issue. You know, adding ports, adding peering is not hard. These people know how to do it. But they are purposely saying, I want to make a whole heck of a lot of money by not paying those fees and not upgrading my links and pass the buck.
Yeah, that's a little sad. Again, it's a complicated problem, and I'm not going to pretend that it's as easy as one company is bad, one person is bad. But I do believe we're definitely heading in the wrong direction. Now, let's go on to the next Enterprise Byte, which is a lot less contentious. It's something that's warm and it's fuzzy and much more friendly, and that is the fact that, yeah, China doesn't want to use Windows 8. Now, China angrily refused to pirate Windows 8 on government PCs. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. On May 20th, China banned the use of Windows 8 on government PCs. A Chinese official strongly suggested, this is one of their passive-aggressive hints, that the ban was a response to the end of Windows XP support by Redmond. We know that they're feeling this because right now, the Ministry of Industry and Information Technology in China reported that upwards of 70% of the PCs across all of China are still running Windows XP. Now, it gets even better than that. An estimated 77% of those PCs are pirated. Breaking that down even further, it's estimated that over 90% of the Windows XP copies in China itself are copied, making it the largest amount of pirated software in the country. So what we have here, Cheever, now I want to throw this over to you for analysis, is a government being upset because Redmond is essentially saying, yeah, we're not going to support XP. And even if we were going to support XP, why would we want to support you when you have bought one copy of the operating system and copied it a billion times?
Oh, gee, I don't feel like opening my wallet and let you take all the cash out of it. That's kind of, you know, what they're asking Redmond to do. It costs money to support product. It costs money to do a lot of things. And China, even though they're trying desperately to develop their economy, they are, let's call a spade, cheating.
Right.
They need to educate their people. They need to have fair trade because that's what's supposed to be, trade. Now, if the United States did the same kind of rules that China puts on us for import of goods, China would be very hard-pressed to sell anything in America. So to my politicians in Congress and so forth, I would say, hey, if China wants to play this way, play the same game. Put the same kind of trade tariffs on them that they put on us. Make it a level playing field all the way across the board.
Cheever, it's always sad when you're so unwilling to speak your mind. Now, still angry, China actually did ratchet up the anger just this last week. On June 4th, Chinese state-run media ran a story deriding Windows 8 as a quote-unquote data thief. They're actually saying that, look, Windows 8 is designed to spy on you. With Windows 8 banned from government PCs, it seems as if they want to keep Chinese individuals from purchasing the newest operating system. Now, this is interesting because we've got Untoward in the chat room, who is saying they want to see the source code of 8. China says Microsoft won't show them the code. However, back in February of this year, Microsoft announced a new initiative about transparency centers. It was announced by Matt Tomlinson, Microsoft's VP of Security, who suggested to the G20 that there should also be a draft of principles for acceptable behavior in cyberspace. Now, these transparency centers were to allow government agencies to come in and take a look at the source code. It was a way to guarantee that, look, there are no back doors. Come in. We're not going to let you copy it, but we'll let you analyze it. We'll let you take a look. We'll give you the assurances that, yeah, this is the code that's running our operating system. There's no government back door that's going to allow the NSA to come in. It's interesting because we haven't heard much about those transparency centers since the announcement in February, but from the sources in the know, China was one of the very first places to get that. There was a branch opened in Beijing, and evidently they used it a lot, but they still came to this conclusion. That leaves me kind of puzzled, Cheebert. Either they had someone take a look at the code and they found something that they didn't like, and that's why they're calling it a data thief, or this is just completely political and they're using this as leverage to say, hey, Microsoft, you need to support Windows XP. Well, what's your take?
I'm just flabbergasted by this whole thing. You know, it's like, what other industry is forced by the governments to open up their intellectual property and private information, you know, their property, the source code, to open inspection? Now, I understand why Microsoft is doing it, and I personally think it's a pretty good move because there has been some mistrust. But come on, China. You've had access to these transparency centers. You've made use of them. What's wrong?
Yeah. It seems to me that if they had actually found something, some offending code that would indicate a backdoor, they would have gone public with it. I mean, that's, of course, they would show the snippets of code. They would have found a way to tell the world, this is why we're not using Windows 8. The fact that we don't see that, even after they've had their chance to pour over the code, it sounds really strange. Who knows?
Yeah, very strange.
Now let's move on. When we come back, we're going to be introducing a brand new guest to the Twiat Riot. We're hoping to hear from him for many, many episodes to come. And we're going to be talking all about VDI. But before that, let's take a moment to welcome the second sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And of course, it's RingCentral. Now, when Leo built the studio, he decided that we were going to do the things that we had been telling our audience to do, namely to move into the cloud. That's why we do everything that we can in the cloud. Our document sharing is in the cloud. Our email is in the cloud. Our calendaring is in the cloud. So when Russell, our IT guy, came to us and told us that we could have a full-featured phone system in the cloud, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. And now RingCentral has launched Meetings. So in addition to all that we love about RingCentral, receiving voicemails through email, sending and receiving fax messages from our smartphones, the auto receptionist who greets our callers and announces employees and department extensions, now with Meetings, we can host face-to-face meetings in high definition and share desktop or documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Meetings makes RingCentral the single best business solution on the market today. So here's what we want you to do. We want to see if maybe RingCentral might be the solution to drive your business to greater productivity. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, just in case they didn't hear you in China, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I'd like you to join me in welcoming to the show brand new guest, hopefully future contributor, Mr. Joseph Panettiere. He is an internet entrepreneur. Joseph, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me, Padre. It's great to be here.
Now, for the folks who are playing along at home, they have seen you on the Twit TV network. You have been an occasional guest on a Twit show here and there. Can you tell them, who are you? What do you do?
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me. So my background is about 20 years in IT media with such brands as Information Week, CMP Media, Ziff Davis Media. In 2008, I launched, or co-launched, I should say, an IT media company focused on the IT channel. That was Nine Lives Media. And at the time, I covered VARs, MSPs, cloud service providers. And now, as you see, my title is Tech Media Entrepreneur, which begs the question, what am I potentially launching next? I haven't said so yet, but as soon as I'm ready to disclose that, I promise, Padre, you'll be among the first to know. And in the meantime, it's great to be a guest here talking about enterprise issues.
You know, there's nothing that our audience likes more than a little bit of intrigue. So now we know that you're in a stealth startup. We're going to be needling you for information. We don't think you're going to give it, but we're still going to be needling you. Now, we brought you in specifically because there's a topic that we have been lacking on Twiat for a while. We talked about it quite a bit at the beginning of the series, but it kind of fell off as the topic kind of got played out. That's VDI, Virtual Desktop Infrastructure. Now, Cheevert is going to take the lead on this. Cheevert, I know you've been doing a lot of work with VDI. In fact, you were working with a firm for a while that was trying to deploy the next generation of VDI. Do you want to tell the Twiat Riot, what VDI is, and what's going to frame our discussion today.
Well, what we really got to do is go back in history a little bit. VDI is a shiny new name to do some to effectively give us what we used to have in the mainframe days, in the days of terminals. We wanted to be able to run applications from a centralized location so that all we were sending was keyboard, mouse, and video. So historically, this particular flavor of VDI started back in the Windows Server 3.5.1 days with Citrix Multiwin, and then continued on and so forth, but was based upon work from the VAX VMS system by Dave Cutler. Anyway, so Microsoft first integrated it in NT4.0 as terminal servers. And what it did was it created virtual desktops. It was still running NT4.0. It was still sharing the server resources, but it allowed you to have the equivalent of, you know, if you do Alt-F1, Alt-F2, Alt-F3 or something for the different desktops in Linux, it was doing almost exactly the same thing. So if you had 10 people running on an NT4.0 machine, those were 10 people sucking up server resources. It was not real popular.
Yeah.
It worked, but it didn't work that great. Anyway, moving up, the big players now are people like Citrix, VMware, and Microsoft. And our friends at Red Hat would be angry with me if I didn't mention them. So Citrix has two flavors, two major flavors, one's called Zen App and another called Zen Desktop. Zen App only exports a single window with a single app. So if you're running a Mac, you could actually open up a Windows app. SAP is a good example. AutoCAD's another good example. VMware has another one called VMware View, and that uses a completely separate transport technology called PC over IP. And then, of course, our friends at Microsoft with RDP and now Remote FX.
Well, Chiebert, hold on. I want to bring in Joe to this discussion in just a bit. Joe, Chiebert's talking a lot about the tech, and that's yep. why we love him. He knows the tech. But there's another angle to this, and that is this idea of VDI, of leveraging central resources, yes. goes back quite a bit. I mean, and there's been a lot promised out of the ability to use the resources of some very few, very powerful computers. What's it like on the entrepreneur side? So once we step away from the tech,
sure.
how does this seem? I know that you know all the buzzwords, you know the talking points that have been going out. Is VDI one of the things that is still hot, or is it kind of cooling off in the shade somewhere?
You know, I think we're on to wave two, and it's heating up again. And I don't want to paint it as that bright and shiny thing that everyone's going to embrace. But boy, it is heating up again. And let me explain why. And I think you hinted about it earlier as we were introducing the topic. In the early days of VDI, I think it was all about let's simplify things. Instead of running around to every PC and managing every PC, let's get those assets up on the server and manage them there. And it didn't work out too well because of bandwidth issues, et cetera, as people were creating boot storms, as they were called in the early days. But what I think is driving this second wave is a combination of things is number one, the mobile devices, the idea that I've now got a laptop, a tablet, a cell phone. Wouldn't it be great if I could get to my server-based apps from any app or from any device, excuse me. So I think that's one driver for VDI. I think the other big driver right now is whether or not to do that on-premise or out in the cloud. So in addition to the solutions that have been mentioned already from Microsoft, Citrix, Red Hat, and the list goes on, VMware, of course, the big question now is, do I deploy that on-premises and manage it myself? And boy, the server vendors would love to sell me a converged infrastructure solution that I run on-premise. Or do I want to go out to the public cloud or a private cloud off-premise? Amazon's introducing desktop as a service offerings. Toshiba's even introducing a combination Citrix and VMware desktop as a service solution. So it's very interesting now how the business discussion has shifted from let's do this on-prem to give me a financial analysis of whether we do this on-prem and buy our own hardware or whether we run it out in a third-party cloud.
Chiebert, what about that? I mean, I want to get back to you and the tech in just a bit, but I heard two serious issues there. And that one, the first one is the rise of the mobile device as sort of an enabler to let us look at VDI again. Even though the idea, the concept is not new, this kind of gave us a fresh look at what it could be. And also the idea of doing off-premise cloud-based central resources for your VDI. Where does that fit into to your history of VDI?
Well, as far as VDI goes, being able to move the computing load from the endpoint device, so mobile, tablet, whatever, into a data center where I can dynamically allocate resources upon need is a big driving force. And it's the reason why it's very popular in different niche markets. I should add a third point. Some of the VDI, not all, but some of the VDI is actually being looked at so that the pieces out in the world, you know, a kiosk, an ATM, whatever, is secure. You know, you still have the connections, but you don't have the intellectual property. You don't have the sensitive information. It could be lost if someone steals the entire PC. If they steal a thin client, oh darn, but none of the intellectual property has gone out. So yeah, that's those are three really big driving forces. And right now, I'm not seeing a huge wave, but I am seeing a lot of niche markets adopting VDI like you would not believe.
Right. Achiever, okay, the chat room is kind of blowing up. Everyone has their favorite VDI flavor, and you know, they're all good. Most VDI solutions work fantastically well for whatever that particular user was using it for. But I understand you've kind of mapped out where the pros and the cons of each of these major technologies lie. Can you share that with us?
Well, I've already talked a little bit about not having intellectual property out in the wild. So keyboard, mouse, and video is basically what's being sent. That also means your communications link doesn't have to be as fat. In fact, I'm actually running stuff over 3G, and it's working just fine. Now, also for licensing, this is another pro. If, like, for instance, I'm running a project where we're using Revit. Revit licenses are not cheap, even for academics. So maybe I have 30 or 40 people in a project team, but I only have at any one time 10 people using Revit. So I'm going to have 10. I'm going to put it into my pool. I'm going to use it. I'm still compliant. I'm still paying my pound of flesh to Autodesk, but I'm making better use of those licenses instead of having it sit on someone's laptop and just sitting there collecting dust, say 95% of the time. And the other thing that is really, really good for academics is being able to go and make that perfect image, the perfect machine for support of a class or whatever, and then put it into a pool and have it spawn off extra copies as people need it. Now, one of the big ones that have been driving, especially the video conferencing people crazy, is when you take your input and outputs, your audio, your video, your microphone, you know, all that stuff, and it's physically separated. So the codecs are in the data center, but you might be 100 miles away. That breaks all kinds of stuff. And that's one of the big frustrations for Skype, for Link, for you name it. They are working on it. Citrix has actually added into their latest version of HDX the Link codecs so that it will work at so forth. The other problem is most of those don't provide two-way audio, or at least at the beginning. They're, a lot of them are starting to finally do two-way audio, and they're finally starting to do multi-touch. So I think one of the reasons why a lot of people are getting excited about VDI is that those types of things. The user experience isn't quite so different from a thick client anymore. And, you know, if users don't like it, they're not going to use it.
Right. Oh, hold up, Chief. I want to come back to you in a bit to talk a bit more about the actual hardware. But let me throw to you, Joe, because one of the things that Chief brought up that really sort of piqued my interest for IT people, the ability to make a secure image to be able to push to someone what they think is the ideal setup, the ideal set of applications for a particular class or a particular group. That's very attractive on the administration side. Security is also great. The ability to let something peer into a session without actually storing the data, maybe sensitive data, on the local device. That's fantastic for security. But the number one thing, every time I've gone to a conference and someone is talking to an executive, the number one thing that they bring up is the licensing. That seems to be the thing that executives, their eyes go, oh, wait, what? And the idea of more efficient use of licensing or cheaper licensing is incredibly attractive. Do you see that a lot in your tech entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. And you know, I think you bring up one side of the story on licensing, but let's bring up the other side. So on the one hand, for a CIO, for a business owner, the licensing could get a lot easier now because now you have everything centralized and you can literally understand what you're licensing. On the flip side, look at a company like Microsoft. Initially, Microsoft and others sort of feared this because they did not want the world to go centralized too quickly because, you know, Microsoft's making a killing all the PC licensing. Fast forward to the present day. Think about what's going on out there. Right now, the dominant operating systems are iOS and Android. So for a way to get Microsoft back in the game and to jack up all their licenses going forward is to finally tip their hat and say, yes, we're going to be much more engaged with end customers who want to do this type of centralized licensing, whether it's on-premise on a VDI system or out in a cloud with a service provider. The number one inhibitor I saw was Microsoft's licensing to third-party service providers, whether it was a big telecom company or emerging cloud providers. It was a nightmare to figure out the licensing schemes with VDI or desktop as a service. Gradually, Microsoft simplifying it because they know they've got to get the Microsoft stamp, the Microsoft image out to iOS and Android devices, and this is one way to do it.
Chira, talk a little bit about that. I know that you've done a lot of work with licensing. That's your job at the university, and that's always been one of the things that the pros is licensing. Tell me, give me an example. Let's take that theoretical 10,000 seat enterprise class network that we're always talking about. Let's say it's an academic institution, so 10,000 seat academic network. What kind of savings, what kind of efficiencies do I get using VDI in terms of licensing?
I'm actually going to directly answer an issue with, say, your standard Microsoft suite. It's not going to save you that much on those types of apps because everybody needs them and the number of simultaneous users is going to be high enough that pooled desktops for that stuff do make sense, but you're still going to need an awful lot of licenses. Where you're really going to save money, or at least where I've saved money, is on the special apps, the ones that cost a lot of money that not a lot of people use all at once, like MATLAB, Autodesk, you know, the Revits and things like that, where people tend to not use them all the time. That's where we've seen big savings. But yeah, Joe's, I totally agree with Joe. Having all your licenses in a place that's easy to get to, easy to manage, means you're going to have a lot less license wastage. That's what drives IT managers crazy, you know, having laptops that are sitting on the shelf.
Joe, sorry?
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the final nail in the coffin for shelfware, if this goes right. So the cloud was sort of the start of that. The whole idea that, if you remember, in 1990s, early 2000s, whether it was ERP software, et cetera, it took years and years to roll out, and who knew how many people were using it, and you always overpaid, and you wound up with quote-unquote shelfware, software licenses that went unused, but you're still paying for them.
Right.
Well, now with everything centralized, assuming it works as advertised, you can take inventory much more easily of how many users you have and then pay accordingly. It's almost like you're moving your desktops to a cloud model, even if it's on-premise VDI.
Right. We've got, Chibert, we've got Alex in the chat room who's saying, look, it's just cloud services, but it actually goes beyond cloud services, right? I mean, when we're talking about VDI, when we're talking about virtual desktop infrastructure, when we're talking about pooled resources, especially for the applications that maybe not everybody needs, it's not just that it's a cloud service, it's that it goes into a pool, which allows you to specifically control how many copies of that software you need.
Yeah. You know, like Joe says, you know, shelfware does nobody any good other than the people collecting the bills.
It does your salespeople a lot of good. They love that.
It's a short-term thing, though.
Right.
You know, at the university, when we have really expensive licenses, like MATLAB, once it got sort of, when they had their licensing so that every user had to have a separate license, we said, no, we're just going to find a different solution. So we pushed back and told them, we're going to buy zero because you're too greedy. what VDI does give us is being able to strike a balance with the software vendors. And that's what it really should be. It should be a partnership. And it's been very one-sided. The users are getting more empowered because of this type of thing, because we can control things and make better use of our IT dollars in this sparse economy.
Joe, what about that? I like that. There's the terminology. Does VDI empower? Does it empower system administrators? Does it empower users? Does it give them a bit of leverage over software vendors that maybe they didn't have before?
Potentially, yes, but I want to be careful here. It sounds like a few of our viewers are saying, hey, this really is just a pure cloud play. Well, it really is in many senses. And while we're trying to empower corporate IT and business executives, we're also running some risks here. And here's a key risk. For VDI that you're going to do on-premise, you still have to modernize your data center in many cases. You can't just start throwing VDI on existing servers in some cases.
Right.
So all the major server vendors, whether it's IBM, HP, Dell, they're all coming out with Cisco is another example. They're all coming out what I would call converged data center systems, servers, storage, networks that converge together to run VDI more effectively, and they're going to position it that way. But there's a lot of upfront investment there, and not every VDI solution is going to run the same. What if you're deploying it centrally, but you've got branch offices in one instance? To your examples that she has brought up, is what if there are niche applications that are video intensive? So I think every deployment is slightly different rather than a vanilla deployment that's just going to deploy once and run everywhere. And I think you're going to run up some hidden costs here in testing.
Gilbert, let's back off the Kool-Aid just a little bit. VDI, obviously, it's exciting because it's a little different than what we're used to. But go a bit deeper into what are the cons. Let's take that same 10,000-seat network. Let's say we've got a VDI deployment going on. What are the things that you would see that would be drawbacks? Of course, there's the audio issue that you've already mentioned, but what else should we be looking at? What as Joe said, would be some of those potentially hidden costs and hidden problems?
Yeah, well, actually, one of the big ones, especially for graphics-intensive, 3D-intensive applications, it gets really expensive. In fact, what I'm experimenting with is for small applications, just Revit, maybe 10 users, the cost of server-based GPUs and the amount of management and learning and all that you have to do, all the big vendors support server-based GPUs now, VMware, Citrix, Microsoft, and they're doing different flavors. There's the per time slice, I get the entire GPU so that I can go crazy. And there's also the Tetris game where I'm taking the provisioning information, meaning the resolution, color depth, and things like that, and I'm playing Tetris with that information in the GPU RAM so that things like Remote FX can actually service multiple 3D calls per time slice. Now, one of the other things that a lot of people keep forgetting is VDI is also getting driven by BYOD.
Yes.
How are you going to run Revit on an iPad? There are SketchUp-like things, but you can't run Revit on an iPad. So having the ability to export an app through, say, ZenApp or Microsoft App Virtualization makes a lot of sense so that you can actually do things. The architectural students are actually making as-built changes when they survey offices and facilities at the University of Hawaii, and they are actually using 3G connections off Apple iPads and making slight changes to the Revit model so we can have an as-built set of plans for the University of Hawaii. What a concept.
Right.
The last thing I want to say, be careful of your licensing. It actually wasn't even legal to virtualize AutoCAD products until they finally got to AutoCAD 2012. So read that end-user license agreement very carefully.
Right. Joe, we do have one question in the chat room, and I think I want to bring it up.
Stump the guest?
this is not a stump the guest, but it's one of these things where anytime there's a conversation about centralized resources, be it the cloud or be it VDI, be it public and private cloud, and it's from Synac, and he says, and if your VDI server goes down, then that's kind of the nightmare. It's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
If I've centralized everything, I've also given myself a major single point of failure, right?
Right.
What are the lessons that you think modern enterprise is learning about VDI? Because that's one of the things they have to solve for, which is you need to have really good high availability tools. You have to have really, really good redundancy if you're planning to do something like deploy VDI.
Right. So I'd give a two-part answer there. Part A of that answer is sort of the Chromebook trend right now. So that is the number one knock when competitors try to knock Chromebooks, where, okay, it's a nice low-cost device that's laptop-like. But once your internet connection's down, it's sort of useless. So that sort of goes to that VDI argument as well. Very similar situation. You're basically taking all that power of PC, but wait a minute, you've made it a worthless device once my network connection goes down or my server farm goes down. Here's my reply. How many of us actually do anything these days with a PC or mobile device without a network connection? When my Wi-Fi is down, I feel helpless anyway. Even if I still have Microsoft Word, Excel, I step away from my laptop, I go get a cup of coffee, and I come back and hope the network connection's back. So it to me now, network connection is like dial tone. Without the network connection, I'm not working anyway. And I know that's sort of it's a cop-out answer, but that's the one I'm going to serve up tonight.
Okay. Joe, that is actually an answer that I hear an awful lot anytime you talk about cloud services.
Right.
Every time you've talked about cloud service, the response has been, oh, yeah, and what happens when it goes down? Oh, so you keep your email in the cloud. Well, what happens when you have no access to the internet? And I don't want to say, oh, well, you're always going to have internet. So, Chiebert,
right.
What is the solution to that? You know, do you have a redundant solution for VDI when you don't have a network connection? Or do we just have to admit, we have to say, look, if you lose network connectivity, yeah, you're just not working.
Yeah, I'm not going to directly answer that because something like this attitude has a slightly different effect. It is, if we buy it, the internet service providers have the impetus, they have the encouragement to go and make it better or make more of it. You know, eat all you want, we'll make more, the buffet attitude. Yeah. If everything goes down, sorry, I can't do a thing. But think of how often you lose all your internet in any facility. With the kinds of service level agreements that corporations have with their providers, that provider is going to normally try really hard not to bring it down because there's probably some penalties involved. So, yeah. It's all your eggs in one basket, but that's getting to be a much, much stronger basket. And considering how many people, how many municipalities are putting in public Wi-Fi, I'm actually being able to get into my lab and run virtual desktops from just about anywhere I travel to. And I do it through a secure connection because there are people that want to mess with me. So it's not yes or no answer. It's a shade of gray.
Shade of gray. Joe, I can't leave us there because right now the chat room is starting to eat itself. This is actually a very good argument. There are going to be people who say, look, if you lose power, are you going to say, well, we shouldn't use computers because that's a single point of failure? To many people, especially to IT administrators, they're saying, look, you're always going to have network access. And if you don't have network access, we're not going to expect you to be able to get anything done. But there are other people, very smart people, very logical people, who do argue, wait a minute, no. If, as who had this? Was it Alex or Dude Fried in the chat room said, if I'm just writing a report, why should I have network access? Why should I have to worry about losing a document in the middle of my work just because a network that I'm not using at all just went away? Is there something that we can offer them other than, well, no, you just have to have a connection. You have to have
dial tone. You know what? I will offer an anecdote in that. Let me paint the picture for you. Every day, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of unfortunate car accidents worldwide, right? And some of them are very tragic, but we don't hear about 99.9.9, you know, and 99.59s out of the car accidents because they're individual events that affect individuals. At the same time, every time an airplane goes down, the whole world seems to stop, and we all get very upset by it because, number one, it's a rare event. And number two, it's a community event. A community of people is affected both directly and indirectly. And what I'm doing is painting a picture and sort of connecting the dots back to IT. Every day, tens of thousands of PCs crash, lose data, and we never hear about it because it's an individual event that happens in an organization in some cubbyhole somewhere. Meanwhile, maybe one cloud service goes down today that we hear about, but we hear about it everywhere. Amazon went dark today, and it happens once every 3 months, 4 months. I don't know what the number is these days. So I guess my point is this. Whether it's VDI or the cloud, it's just getting more and more and more reliable. And when we do hear about the outages, I think we all sensationalize it because it's a group community outage rather than an individual event.
Right, right. It's hard to hear. There's something psychological
Absolutely.
That doesn't want to admit that, yeah, this might affect me every once in a while, but it's really not that significant. Cheever, yeah. Let me throw go ahead, Joe.
And one follow-up. No one's saying, by the way, with VDI that you have to centralize everything. It's almost like the hybrid cloud argument. Yes, let me move some assets out to the cloud, but I'm going to keep a lot local. Same thing with VDI. On the one hand, we're saying, hey, maybe thin clients, you would move everything up to a central server. But with a full-blown PC, you can do hybrid. You can still have files locally if you choose, if your administrators set it up that way for you. So it's not an either or, it can be a hybrid.
Now, Cheever, actually, let's talk about this hybrid because I've seen that work in enterprise before. And the problem that people get into when they're trying to run these hybrid setups where you've got something local and you've also got something that comes in through VDI, comes over the remote network link, is that then it kind of screws up the licensing again, right? Because now you don't just have a VDI terminal, you have licensing you have to build in on the local box as well as the licensing you have to pay for over the centralized VDI resources.
Actually, it's changing. Just look at how the Office 365 is licensed. You can still download a copy that'll work without an internet connection. It just wants to be able to phone home once in a while to make sure you're in compliance with the license. But you can also run it up in the cloud. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying it's what everybody should go to, but I am saying the industry is changing and the licenses for things like Office 365 are taking into account that there is a hybrid world out there and it's not yes or no, it's a shade of gray, and I'm going to sound like a broken record.
I love our chat room. Again, it's a very good technical discussion that's going on in there, but someone just pulled the ultimate. They're now talking about, well, nuclear war and an EMP. So if you did an EMP, you would really mess up people's VDI systems.
but their desktops wouldn't be affected.
Touche, Internet. Touche. Actually, Cheever, I want to give you this. I want to ask you about this. It seems as if we've now hit the sticking point. I mean, the sticking point's not really performance anymore because you can find VDI solutions that have great performance. The sticking point's not licensing because I think we've all acknowledged that, yeah, these companies are figuring out the licensing. As you just said, they're even figuring out hybrid licensing. The sticking point is really connectivity. The point is people are afraid that if I go with a virtual desktop infrastructure solution, at some point when I most need it, I'm going to be disconnected and my computer won't work the way it should. I mean, is that the thing that holds VDI back?
You bet. Maybe I'm on that 10% or whatever on Verizon that's 90% congested, you know. There are things like that. People still don't trust their internet connections. There's a lot of throwback to the dial-up days. Oh, I got knocked off the ISP. Broadband has gotten significantly more reliable. And, you know, now that Google Fiber is rolling out and Fios and things like that, we're now starting to see some bandwidth going into residential areas that can rival that of a corporation. Yes, there's a lot of places where their internet just is either non-existent, broadband's terrible, but competition seems to be helping. I'm hearing less and less people saying my broadband is either non-existent or I don't have any or it's always broken. I don't hear this as much. So the world is changing. Broadband is the people don't even talk about broadband penetration numbers anymore. It's almost an assumption that if you are someplace, you can get broadband of one form or another. So I think, yeah, I think we've got a lot of knee-jerk reactions that I don't trust it. I don't trust the communications, but that is changing. And certainly the new generation, I don't even hear it from them anymore.
What about that, Joe? Is this not a technological problem? Is this just a perception problem? I mean, is this initial knee-jerk?
I have a two-part answer there. And, you know, let's remember VDI does not have to be out in the cloud. VDI can be on-premises, which means, you know, if I'm a bank, for instance, and I want to do VDI out to my teller stations, well, that may go from my teller stations to my local data center. And you know, so it's not going over the public internet or going out to a public cloud. So that mitigates some of the concerns about public broadband, and I think the concerns are overblown anyway. I think the bigger issue is one of control, no disrespect meant, but I will call a portion of the IT administrators out there, you know, they're server huggers. They don't want to let go of the servers because they view the server as their job and the applications that ride atop the server as their bread and butter expertise. And if you take VDI and do it on-premise, well, you're still able to hug that and still own it and still manage it for your company. Once you put it out in a cloud setting on a third-party server, yeah, you can still manage it, you can still take care of it, but there's a little bit of concern there that it's not truly yours, and you worry about your own job security at that point. And I think we have to get over that hurdle because at the rate we're going, it seems like the whole CapEx OpEx debate has really shifted to cloud economics.
I had never heard the term server huggers before. That's one of my new favorite phrases. Thank you very much. I love that.
Now, gentlemen, yeah, and again, no disrespects meant to. I know the vast majority of IT managers out there and executives want to do what's right by the company, but I think there is a portion that sort of has to let go of their inhibitions and really look at the economics of this.
Yeah, I got it. Thank you. I think we just came up with our show title. Now, gentlemen, we are coming to the end of our episode. I'm sorry we used up another hour listening to the best enterprise podcast in the world, but I do want to give both of you some parting shots. And here's what I'm looking for. If you were to think of the best argument to go with VDI and the biggest con of VDI, what would that be? And I want to alternate here. I'm going to start with you, Chiebert, because you're my co-host, and I love putting you on the spot. But if you were to think of the number one reason why a new enterprise, a new IT admin should go with a strong VDI deployment, what would it be? One argument.
For pro, I'd say BYOD. For con, I'd say internet service provider latency and jitter.
All right. So, we've got it from Chiebert. From Chiebert is BYOD is perfect. It fits right hand in hand with VDI. And on the con is what we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes, and that is you do have to stay connected. So if you're worried about that, you have to consider that. What's your pro? What's your con?
I was going to say just for kicks, ditto, just to steal his answers. But you know what? I do have another answer for pro, and it gets back to the Windows XP licensing. And imagine this, you know, when you go to a retailer right now, if you look at that retail point of sale system, chances are it's running Windows XP in a good percentage of time. So I would say point of sale Windows XP systems, VDI could be a great solution to get those same systems upgraded to a centralized either Windows 7 or Windows 8 environment. And now you're not swapping out all the hardware. So that would be a pro. You know, a con for me would be let me focus on the on-premise portion of this. You know, forget the cloud side, which I'd refer to as desktop as a service, but on-premise, which I'd say is, I would just be very careful of vendors saying that you can deploy this on your current hardware without really thinking about your server storage and network configurations. And on the flip side, if your current infrastructure isn't going to be able to run it, boy, you may be looking at a major, major upgrade cost to put this in your data center with all the hardware converged.
Gentlemen, thank you so very much. Very thoughtful debate, very thoughtful discussion. That, you know, VDI obviously is something that we're going to be hearing more and more of. And I'm with you, Joe. I think one of the biggest rollouts of VDI that we're going to see in the next year is in POS. We're going to see it in point of sale systems, especially with this move to more secure stations. Chibert, I think that BYOD is absolutely going to be a big player in the enterprise. We're going to be seeing more and more enterprises scramble to figure out a way that they can securely give their BYOD users access to secure network resources. And as you have said, I think VDI is right up that alley. Now, gentlemen, now that we are at the end of This Week in Enterprise Tech, I want to thank you both for being part of this panel. And I want to let you talk to the Twilight Riot and tell them where they can find you, what you're working on, and where they should go to find more of your content. Chibert, let's start with you. We know you. We love you. We know that you're going to be here every Monday on This Week in Enterprise Tech. But where can the Twilight Riot find your latest endeavors?
I am continuing to publish with InfoWorld.com. And I'm obviously on TV network. But, you know, Twilight Riot, I'm working pretty hard on working with Microsoft so we can start getting it and making it easier for us to get Microsoft engineers and product specialists on Twilight without having to go through a lot of hoops, which means maybe in a not too long, we're going to be able to have a VDI product specialist that might start talking about some of the brand new things that Microsoft is going to be bringing out. Ought to knock your socks off.
I like myself without socks. Let's do that. Joe, what about you? Thank you for being on This Week in Enterprise Tech. This definitely won't be the last time you're on. Can you tell the Twilight Riot where they can find you, your work, and maybe you could give us a couple of hints about this super secret stealth thing you're doing?
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me, first of all. So a couple of things, a few places to find me. Number one, I'm on Tech News Today with Mike Elgin every Tuesday. I'm a guest host there, so we're talking about the news of the day. Join us there. We'd love to hear from you. You can find me right on Twitter talking about what I'm up to each day at Joe Panettiere. And then I invite you to visit my previous brands, the three brands that I used to blog on every day, continue strong. They continue to grow. Those are the VAR Guy, MSP Mentor, and Talking Cloud. I've since sold those to Penton Media, my co-founder and I. It was acquired by Penton Media a few years ago, and we've recently exited there. And we wish those brands well. Great teams over there. In terms of what I'm up to next, I'll give you a hint. I'm in Philadelphia. I live in New York. I'm in Philadelphia this weekend for a tech event here where I'm doing some research on what I'll be doing next. Now, if anyone can figure out what that event is, that's a big flag as to what I'm up to. And then right in my title, entrepreneur there. You know, I've got entrepreneurship in my blood, and, you know, I'm in the tech industry, so you can bet I'll be doing something in the IT media space soon. Look for that. I can't say when, but stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Actually, now that you've given me those clues, anyone can Google and figure out what you're doing, so that's fantastic. Joe Chibert, thank you so very much, and we will see you again. Now, I also want to thank you. That's right, our loyal viewer, our loyal listener, for staying with us on This Week in Enterprise Tech. It is the best dang podcast in the world, according to 6 out of 7 popes. I just checked. Now, we want you to automatically get our episodes. You know, we don't want this to be a trial, a tribulation. So what we'd like you to do is drop by our show notes page, our show page at twit.tv/twiet. There you'll find a drop-down menu that will give you all the different options for getting This Week in Enterprise Tech into your device of choice in the format that you want. Do you want the audio version for the car on your iPhone? You can do that. Do you want the low-definition video for your Android phone? You can do that. Do you want the high-definition video for your tablet so you can watch it on your TV when you get home? You can do that. You can also find us on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and download our podcast because it's what keeps us going round. Also, you can find us on Twitter. Actually, you can find me on Twitter. Find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll see what I do each and every single day, even outside of This Week in Enterprise Tech. You'll see how I prepare for my other shows on the Twit TV network, like Know How, our do-it-yourself show at 11 o'clock on Thursdays, Coding 101, our show about programming Thursdays at 1:30, and Padre's Corner, the show where I kind of just do anything I want, Fridays at 7 o'clock p.m. Finally, I want to thank everyone here in the Brick House who made this show possible, to Carson, my super producer, to Alex, who won't show himself because he's shy, but he stood in for TD today, and he did it with a margarita in one hand. I have no idea how he was able to do that. And, of course, to Liz, who is ending her tenure here at twit.tv. We love her. We're going to miss her. And, oh, she's already gone. That's so, and actually, I just hear her voice, so I guess she's not gone. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.